Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Fred Pitts. Later on in the hour, we'll talk to the directors Marlo McKenzie and Jonathan Parker about their new documentary, Carol Dota, Topless at the Condor. And we'll check in with artistic director of the vertical dance company, Bandaloop. But first, this week is National Sexually Transmitted Infection Awareness Week, or STIs. And to kick it off, we'll be starting our show with the latest news on STIs in San Francisco. In the setting of an alarming rise in STIs nationwide, researchers at UCSF and the San Francisco Department of Public Health have shown that a single dose of an antibiotic called doxycycline can turn that tide. Here to discuss their study are Dr. Stephanie Cohen and Dr. Annie Lutkemeyer. Dr. Cohen is the director of HIV and STI prevention at the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Dr. Lutkemeyer is a clinical professor of medicine and infectious diseases, as well as medical researcher at UCSF. Stephanie, Annie, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thanks for having us.
Hi.
Stephanie, before we jump into your study, let's set the stage. Can you give our listeners a quick review of syphilis and chlamydia so we understand the kinds of diseases that you're trying to eradicate?
Sure. Syphilis and chlamydia are both sexually transmitted infections, which we refer to as STIs. They are caused by bacteria, and they can cause a range of different symptoms and different severity. Some of you may have heard of syphilis. It's a fascinating and also actually quite a historic infection. There's been many famous and infamous people throughout history who were thought to have had syphilis, ranging from Al Capone to Oscar Wilde to Beethoven. Syphilis is one of the more serious STIs. If untreated, it can go on to cause complications because it can infect our nervous system. So it can cause things like blindness, deafness, and meningitis. Chlamydia is also an STI. It's caused by a different bacteria, and it can cause pain with urination and genital discharge. It's often asymptomatic, which means that the infection is silent. So sometimes chlamydia can only be detected through screening because someone may have it but not know that. And chlamydia can increase the risk for transmitting HIV or getting HIV, and it can also cause infertility. So it's a serious infection as well.
Thank you. Annie, let's jump to the study. Can you explain in layman's terms what it is you studied and what were your findings?
So in this study, which we call the DoxyPEP study, we enrolled people who had an elevated risk for having a bacterial STI, so gonorrhea, syphilis, or chlamydia. So we offered enrollment to men who have sex with men or transgender women who were either living with HIV or who were taking a medicine to prevent HIV called PrEP. And they had to have had at least one of those infections in the last 12 months and report condomless sex with at least one male partner. So this is a group that was already enriched for risk for sexually transmitted infections because they already had had one. And what we did in this study is that we randomized them, so flipped a coin and assigned them to a strategy of offering them this antibiotic every time after they had condomless sexual encounter or standard of care, which does not involve receiving that medication. And that strategy, the intervention we call DoxyPEP, which stands for post-exposure prophylaxis, meaning something that you do after you are exposed. And they would take a single dose of an antibiotic called doxycycline as soon as possible. And we recommended within 24 hours, but no later than 3 days after they had condomless sex. We used doxycycline because there were some preliminary studies that suggested it would be effective to reduce the incidence of all three of these medicines taken after an exposure. So our hope was that we would reduce the amount of sexually transmitted infections we saw in people who received DoxyPEP. And that's what we found. So first of all, in people who didn't receive DoxyPEP, we looked in increments of every 3 months. And we saw that on average, about 30% of the people had one or more new sexually transmitted infection every 3 months. So that's a lot. And we saw that there was a reduction of about 2/3 each quarter in those who were taking DoxyPEP, so reduced from about 30% to around 10% overall. We found that DoxyPEP was most effective in reducing chlamydia and syphilis, It did have an effect on gonorrhea as well. It cut the rates by about half, but it's important to note that it wasn't as effective in gonorrhea.
Impressive. Why did you study men who have sex with men and transgender females who have sex with men specifically?
In San Francisco, these are two populations, men who have sex with men and trans women, who have particularly high rates of STIs. And over the last decade, we have seen rising rates of STIs in these communities. So here at the Health Department at San Francisco DPH and at UCSF, as well as our collaborators on the study in Seattle, all felt that there was a very urgent need to study effective prevention options for these communities. In addition, there had been a couple of smaller studies done previously of DoxyPEP that looked at the intervention for men who have sex with men and trans women. And those studies served as a proof of concept that DoxyPEP could work. And they really laid the foundation for us.
On that note, syphilis rates among women are rising, as are the rates of babies born with congenital syphilis. Are there any studies on the horizon to study these populations?
Yeah, so I want to just mention that while we really prioritized men who have sex with men and trans women in our study, we know that syphilis rates are really impacting women and especially pregnant women. And chlamydia is actually, you know, a real issue in women also, especially because it can be associated with impacts on infertility. So unfortunately, the first study that looked at DoxyPEP in women to reduce rates of chlamydia did not show positive findings. This was a study that was done in Kenya, and they didn't have high rates of syphilis in that population. So that's not what the study was designed to do. But they did not find an effect in this group. And there's a lot of discussion about why that may be, but at least in part, we think it's because the enrollees may not have taken DoxyPEP enough after having condomless sex to reduce their rates of infection. So I think there's a lot of interest here, especially because of the rates of congenital syphilis that you're mentioning, syphilis that is contracted during pregnancy. So there are studies that are in planning and going forward to look at adolescent and young women who are at risk for chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis. And we're all very hopeful that those will be able to go forward.
Well, can we extrapolate the data from your study to presume this regimen of DoxyPEP would be beneficial for women too?
Yes. So you're right that there isn't a really clear biological reason why DoxyPEP wouldn't work in women. We know that drug levels of doxycycline look like they reach a high enough level in the female genital tract, which is where you would want to see the medications to help prevent infection. So we need to really understand why the study I mentioned didn't work. And again, in part, that may have been because the participants just didn't take enough of the medications. So I am optimistic that doxycycline will work in women. It's not right now recommended for women in the CDC draft guidelines. But I think all of us feel like for women who have an elevated risk, there are some women for whom this might be a choice that they want to make with some shared decision-making with their provider.
Stephanie, medical research is invaluable, but putting what we learn into action is equally important. I understand this is where you come in. How did this study change San Francisco's public health guidelines, and how has that affected the population at large?
Yeah, Fred, I agree. I think translating evidence into action is something that we're not always as successful at in medicine and in public health as we need to be. And the DoxyPEP study results were really, truly groundbreaking. You know, we had been searching for new, highly effective STI prevention tools, or at least we'd been in need of those tools, you know, for quite a long time. So we really, at San Francisco Department of Public Health, felt that it was imperative that we move quickly to get guidance out to providers and to patients about how they could use DoxyPEP safely and effectively. And we came together and in October 2022, we're the first health department in the country to release citywide guidelines for DoxyPEP. Many other local health jurisdictions have followed suit and released guidelines, as has the California Department of Public Health. And as Annie mentioned, the CDC has released draft DoxyPEP guidelines for public comment, but the official CDC guidelines are still pending. So, you know, we released those guidelines and we found that there's been a ton of interest in our communities in using DoxyPEP. And so we've been tracking that to try to understand how many folks are using DoxyPEP in San Francisco. And part of our role at the health department is also to track number of STI cases. So we've done some analyses to see, okay, has anything actually changed in our communities to whom we're offering DoxyPEP since we released the guidelines? And we recently presented an analysis at a conference on HIV and STIs where we showed that, in fact, after years and years of increasing STIs, in the last 12 months after the release of our DoxyPEP guidelines, we have actually seen a decline in both syphilis and chlamydia in men who have sex with men in San Francisco. So these are really quite striking results. We need longer follow-up and, you know, we need data from other jurisdictions to really understand if this was all from DoxyPEP. But the data are quite suggestive that the intervention could potentially have a population level effect, which is what we're aiming for.
Well, this has all been great information. I'd like to wrap it up, but before we do, this is National STI Week. Do you have any parting words of advice for our listeners out there on how to stay safe?
I would encourage the listeners who are sexually active to talk with their healthcare provider and their partners about what they can do to stay healthy, about getting screened for STIs, including HIV. And this is really important because, like I mentioned earlier, not all STIs cause symptoms. So screening is an important piece of that. Going to the primary care doctor is always a good place to start. And for folks who don't have primary care or who may be uninsured, they can come to our health department run sexual health clinic, San Francisco City Clinic, where we prescribe DoxyPEP and HIV PrEP and provide other comprehensive sexual health services like vaccines, testing, treatment, et cetera.
Well, unfortunately, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us tonight, Stephanie and Annie.
Thanks for having us.
We'll talk to Marlo McKenzie and Jonathan Parker, directors of the new documentary, Carol Doda, Topless at the Condor. That's right after the break. Stay with us.
It's difficult to imagine an America without tipping in restaurants or wherever else.
Tipping is such an American thing today, right?
But the reality is that tipping hasn't always been around the way we think of it today.
When tipping first came, it was the most un-American thing to have to tip. And now it's the most un-American thing to take it away.
The long, complicated legacy of tipping in America.
On the next Throughline from NPR.
Throughline. Tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock here on KALW.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Salman Rushdie talks about the knife attack while he was on stage. The doctors didn't expect him to survive. This was 33 years after Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini issued a fatwa, a religious ruling calling for Rushdie's death as punishment for his book, The Satanic Verses. Rushdie's new book is called Knife. Join us.
That's right. Join us tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock for Fresh Air on 91.7 KALW.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Fred Pitts. We want you to be part of this next conversation. We're going to be talking about the new documentary, Carol Doda, Topless at the Condor. Do you remember North Beach in its heyday, or the Carol Doda sign with the strategically placed blinking lights at the corner of Columbus and Broadway? Do you think that the topless dancer craze in the 60s really changed our perceptions of female nudity or our attitudes on sex? And if so, how? Give us a call. We're at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay at
www.tipsfromtheheart.org. In 1964, Carol Doda shook up our culture and ideas around sex when she strutted on the stage wearing nothing but a monokini. Set in the midst of the sexual revolution, this documentary of Carol Doda's life makes us question our thoughts on women's sexuality. Here to discuss their film with us tonight are the directors, Marlo McKenzie and Jonathan Parker. Marlo, Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Great. Great you're here. Jonathan, I'm going to start with you. Just tell us, how did you two decide to do this film?
Well, I actually met Carol when she opened a lingerie store on Union Street after she retired from dancing. And my office overlooked the courtyard where her store was, and she was very famous, and but I realized I didn't really know her story, and I started to look into it, and was really struck by this kind of random confluence of events that launched her career. She was a go-go dancer who danced on a piano that was lowered from the ceiling. There was a Republican convention of 1964 coming to San Francisco, and the club owners were trying to figure out how to get business into the club. And then just when that happened, the famous fashion designer from the 60s, Rudy Gernreich, came out with a monokini, which was a bathing suit that did not cover the breasts. And so the club owner bought it, bought one for her, and the rest was history. And so I talked to Carol about doing a movie. I was an aspiring filmmaker. This was in the late 90s, and she was receptive. And so we got to talking about it, and I followed her around on a number of her master of ceremonies type public appearances. Mm-hmm. And she was singing in a little jazz combo at the time. And the project did not come together at that time, and I kind of put my file of notes in a drawer. And then 20 years later, Marlo and I were working on a different project when Marlo discovered the notes.
So I discovered his notes, and I didn't know who Carol Doda was. Mm-hmm. And so I just did some research, and the times were really amazing. It was just before the sexual revolution and before the summer of love, and this was a time when women were very restricted, and Carol became clear she was a rule breaker. She decided she was going to have a career when that wasn't something women really dreamed of, and she was going to be in entertainment. And so she really pushed the envelope, and it was something that I found really brave, and I thought it was something that would be great to pursue. Mm-hmm. Jonathan and I talked about it. We decided to reopen the project after all of those years.
Wow. How much of the original notes did you use for the film?
Well, I think the only part of the original notes we ended up using was my song list. I had come up with a soundtrack, you know, that I envisioned for what at that time was going to be a dramatic feature. And we did end up using a lot of those songs.
Okay. Jonathan, can you paint us a picture here? What was North Beach like around 1960 when Carol Doda was, I guess you call her, the queen of the condor?
Well, in when Carol first went dance topless in 1964, the Broadway Street, believe it or not, if you know it now, it was the nightclub area in San Francisco at a time when everybody was going to nightclubs. It was a thing where, you know, fashionable couples would get dressed up and go down to Broadway. And a lot of these clubs were, doing pretty big business. And so it's hard to imagine knowing Broadway now, but that's what it was like. It was described as the off-season Vegas.
Wow. That's how it comes across in the documentary I was watching. I was surprised to know that was a tourist section for people to come and just go to clubs. You know, husbands and wives would just go and hang out. I have a question for both of you, and either one of you can answer, or you can just do it in tandem. 1964 rolls around, and Carol Doda famously wears the, or appears in the monokini, or rather, I guess you call it a half bikini. Was Doda's monokini stunt like a sign of the times? Was it a woman claiming her right to her own body and declaring her sexual freedom? Or was it just really a club gimmick?
Well, I think you would have to say it was kind of a club gimmick at that point, because there was not a whole lot of intent. The Chronicle headlines at that time were "Monokini arrives," and it was a big deal. And who's going to be the first wearing the topless bathing suit? I think was the second day's headline. So that was about as much thought, revolutionary thought, as went into it at that time.
But I would like to add that I think that coming out of the 50s, it was a very, people were just waiting for this to happen. Mm-hmm. It was a very repressed time in the 50s in terms of sexuality, and it was going to happen at some point. So Carol Doda just happened to be, in 1964, the person that was handed this monokini at exactly the time in history when, it was just about to burst on the scene, the free love and what we saw with the hippies and, 67. And so it definitely was a sign of pent up sexuality, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Who was the person or who were the persons who actually gave the monokini to Carol Doda? How did that come into her possession?
Well, one of the I think it was the idea basically of the club publicist Davy Rosenberg.
Mm-hmm.
And the two club owners, Gino Del Prete and Pete Mattioli, were involved, and they collectively decided that they should do this. And Davy went down to, I believe it was Joseph Magnin, and bought this bathing suit and gave it to Carol.
Wow. Lucky her. Just have to be the right place at the right time, I guess. Now, the 60s, we'll just call it a time of bra burning and feminism, or as we learn in your film, attempted bra burning. Technically, Doda was also doing away with her own bra. How was she seen by the feminists? Did they feel that she added to sexual liberation, or did they feel that she was making matters worse by, I guess, capitulating to male sexual expectations? And that's for either one of you.
You kind of broke up a little bit, but I can answer the question. Wait, could you say it again?
Sure. So the 1960s were a time of bra burning and feminism, or like as they say in the film, attempted bra burning. Carol Doda was kind of doing away with her bra. How was she seen by feminists? We'll just start with that question.
How is she seen? Well,
by feminists.
I don't think that feminists... Yeah, feminists, I don't think she really came on the scene in terms of feminist discourse then. It's really now through this film that I think she's getting more attention, and she would have, feminism can now take her up and start discussing her role and her cultural contribution towards, which I think many feminists would say sort of like an expression of female desire.
Mm-hmm.
So, that mostly came in with the hippies, and the sexual revolution. I don't think Carol Doda was really discussed much at that time. We didn't come across that, but I'm hoping that she is discussed now, because she had a great contribution towards sexual revolution and opening up what it means to be comfortable with your body, comfortable with nudity, and as a woman expressing yourself in this way and saying it's okay to do that. So she really did kind of break some barriers through her actions.
Okay. This is State of the Bay, local public radio, 91.7 KALW, Bay Area. I'm Fred Pitts. We're discussing the documentary Carol Doda, Topless at the Condor, with directors Marla McKenzie and Jonathan Parker. Question is for the audience. Do you think nude and topless dancers helped or hindered the feminist cause? And why are some still so unsettled at the thought of the naked body? You can join us by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.com. Another question here. Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, highlighted the fact that women could and should be more than just housewives with aprons. Betty Friedan, I mispronounced her name. Did Friedan intend this new freedom to extend to adult entertainment? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, one of my favorite quotes in there is that in order for a man or a woman to realize themselves, it's necessary for them to express themselves creatively.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that I interpret that is we are all different and we would express ourselves differently. Carol chose to express herself in this way, and I view it as a creative act. Mm-hmm. So this would be very personal. Other people wouldn't really view it that way. But the way that I interpret Betty Friedan's comments, I think it could totally embrace Carol and what she did.
Okay. We have an email question from Wendy in San Francisco. She wants to know, was Carol Doda a native San Franciscan?
Carol was from Vallejo originally.
Okay, so Bay Area native. All right. Did she live in the Bay Area the entire time, her whole life?
I'm sorry, for her whole life?
Yeah, was she in the Bay Area her whole life? Yes.
Yeah, she grew up in Vallejo, and she moved to San Francisco probably in 61, 62, around mm-hmm. there.
Okay, so she's been out here for a while. Okay. Another question for either one of you. Carol Doda seemed to find her strength in using the male gaze to her advantage. You all ended up interviewing a lot of adult entertainers for this project. Did you find that most of them shared her opinion, or did they feel that they were exploited?
Well, what I would say is when people talk about using the male gaze to their advantage, it often means it's a transaction where she gained financial, she had financial gain from it.
Mm-hmm.
But I like to think of it more in terms of the joy that she had. So Carol, when you look at all of the footage and when you see the movie, you can see that she really came alive. She really loved being on stage. This is something she was meant to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for women to stand up and say, I enjoy expressing myself sexually in this way, that was a way of leveraging the male gaze, and that was how she chose to do it. But I think it's more in terms of joy rather than, you know, the commercial aspect of it.
Yeah, Carol really wanted to be a nightclub entertainer. She was a big fan of Frank Sinatra, and that was really her dream. And as she says in the film, she wanted to be in show business, and she didn't know any other way than to start showing her business.
I remember that quote. I think you all do at least in my opinion, a masterful job of just showing the joy that she had as you watch her interviews. You know, there's a pride that she has in what she was doing with her own career. Let me just also add that there's another part of this email that was sent in from Wendy in San Francisco. She also wants to know how much of Carol's success was dependent on business from sailors or other soldiers from the Presidio?
From soldiers from the Presidio?
Yeah, from sailors or soldiers from the Presidio.
Well, she was very popular with... San Francisco was at that time, you know, soldiers were getting shipped out to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and she was very popular as, you know, with those, you know, men who were coming to San Francisco as part of the military. And then being sent to Vietnam. But she, you know, she was really popular with a lot of people who were coming to San Francisco, a lot of sales conventions. As soon as the topless thing broke and it was, you know, quite famous, people wanted their sales conventions to be held in San Francisco. They really wanted to see this act. So military personnel were a part of it, but there was also, you know, many other types of tourists, including couples that were coming to San Francisco. They wanted to see the topless shows.
Wow. I didn't know that. Jonathan, question for you. Carol Doda's monokini performance at the Condor sparked a topless craze, if you will. In Doda's wake, there were topless bands, topless shoeshine girls, and a topless clam chowder joint, which you talk about in the documentary. And this sudden craze was met with resistance from the city. Can you take us through the many legal battles that ensued because of that?
Well, there was, you know, the neighborhood, the North Beach neighborhood. It was, you know, an Italian neighborhood at that time. There, the church was quite strong, and there was definitely pushback against this topless entertainment. So finally, like, I think about, you know, maybe 9 months after she started dancing topless, the police raided not just the Condor, but all of the topless clubs on Broadway. They arrested all the dancers. And there was a famous trial. The dancers were represented by Melvin Belli and others, and then they were acquitted because basically the prosecution failed to convince a judge and a jury that there was a consensus as to what it meant to be, you know, for entertainment to be considered obscene in San Francisco. So they were acquitted, and then San Francisco became the first city in the nation where topless dancing was legal.
Can you tell me what year that was again?
That was in 1965.
Wow. Now, I also remember that there was a 1970 board ruling. Can you talk a little bit about that? Was it a little bit different than what happened in 65?
Yeah, it was, because what happened is, you know, as all the clubs went topless and they were always trying to top each other, they eventually, several years later, went bottomless as well. Mm. And Carol was the first, you know, entertainer to go to dance completely nude. And then there was another crackdown. And what ended up happening is that the Alcohol Beverage Control Board determined that if there was going to be alcohol served, they couldn't be bottomless. And so that kind of, you know, killed bottomless, basically, because obviously these clubs depended on alcohol sales for their livelihood. And I think it was being compared to the theater. You know, Hair was a popular show at that time, and there were nude performers in the musical Hair. And so the clubs were saying, well, why can't we do it? Well, you can't do it, they decided, because they were serving alcohol.
Mm. Wow. There was something about that era or that law that was tagged under the 21st Amendment, correct? Because that repealed prohibition?
Well, I don't know exactly what amendment that was.
It was the 21st Amendment with the repealing of prohibition. The California Alcoholic Beverage Control Board has the right to regulate the type of entertainment and establish that is licensed to sell drinks. So it's one of those history things that I guess was a little bit related to this verdict or this decision. I want to say that Peter in Marin writes, quote, "I grew up in San Francisco as a young boy. I remember driving down Broadway to go down to the on-ramp of the freeway and would ogle at the iconic neon lights with the flashing lights on her bra and wonder, what is going on down there? I want to thank you for the great documentary showing the social movement afoot there." So that was from Peter in Marin.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
There's also a question. Whatever happened to the sign? Seems like a historical monument in itself. I guess the Carol Dota sign.
Yeah, the famous sign was split into a top half and a bottom half. You know, it was a 40-foot tall sign. Mm-hmm. The bottom half is still in the Condor Club. So if you go to the Condor Club, you can see the bottom half of the sign. And I have to tell you, I do not know who ended up with the top half of the sign, but it's possible that that can be determined.
Okay. Half a sign goes one place, half a sign goes the other place. Interesting. I've got a question for you all. I'm going to move on slightly here to the topic of silicon. It was no secret that Carol Doty used silicon to increase her breast size, or her bra size, breast size, really. She said that she's gone from a B cup to a 44 double D. And her breasts were affectionately known as two of San Francisco's most famous landmarks. Can you take us through what's the story of silicon? I mean, where did it come from, and then how did it end up being used by entertainers like Carol Dota?
Yeah, so we talk about this in the movie, how during World War II, Japanese prostitutes were influenced by what the American men wanted. Mm-hmm. And so they began to inject themselves with silicone that was stored in vats there at the harbors. And, you know, in 1964, it had found its way to the U.S. And when Carol was first dancing topless, she had some pressure because she was, you know, a 32B and people wanted her to kind of be bigger. They were making fun of her breast size. So partly, you know, because of her career, she wanted to succeed in her career. So she began a series of injections of silicone, which were very experimental at the time. Mm-hmm. They were just starting to come out with the silicone bags, but those weren't quite there yet when Carol was around. So she began to get a series of injections. She had 44 injections, and Judy Mamou, who was the second person to go topless, she also got the injections, and it turned into this kind of like almost like competition of I want to be bigger than you. And we go through this in the movie, but we also talk about you know, the repercussions of that and what happened, because with silicone, gangrene can set in. Mm-hmm. And you can get hardened encapsulations in the silicone, and it was a very dangerous thing to do to your body, although, you know, they did not know that at the time. They thought it was safe. So this is an important part of the story, because you kind of ask yourself, would Carol have been as famous if she hadn't done this? And what would I do if I was in her situation and I had this dream? It's important part of her story that kind of made her who she was.
She was. This is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW, Bay Area. I'm Fred Pitts. We're discussing the new documentary, Carol Doda, Topless at the Condor, with directors Marlo McKenzie and Jonathan Parker. Carol Doda strutted across stages proud of her silicone implants. Do you think, audience, that these breast augmentations have been good or bad for women and their image? You can join us by calling at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Marla, I've got a question for you. What did breast augmentation do for women's relationships with their own breasts and body image?
Well, that's something we've been discussing quite a bit after the movie screenings. It's a very personal thing. It would depend on each woman, and you know, some women find it's very helpful. It's improved their confidence. They feel more like themselves. And other women feel like it's been harmful. It's given women an image that we can't live up to. We can't live up to these beauty standards that are sort of pressured onto us by media or culture or social media. But I think what's important here is that we have to have the option for every woman to be able to choose what they feel is right for them. And that's really the key of that. I think this story is bringing out, let's talk about this and embrace the range of what women want in their lives and what they feel comfortable with.
Okay. Now, when I watched this documentary, I also thought it was sort of a love letter, at least that's how I took love letter to the North Beach area and just the Broadway, I guess the Broadway club scene, what it used to be and how it's changed. To quote your movie, Broadway in North Beach used to be well-to-do couples on dates, and now it's just skeevy dudes in overcoats. This is a question for either one of you. When did the change happen? And I mean, when did the neighborhood decline and why? What happened?
Well, one of the things that happened was the porn industry was invented, the film porn industry. And so, you know, that when that came in the 70s, things really started to change. The topless scene, you know, started to wane, and the types of entertainment, the clubs began to shift from being really this kind of, you know, nightclub acts that, you know, kind of came out of the 50s era, really, into more of these kind of nude encounter parlors. And they, you know, so where it became a kind of a con job for the clubs at that time to kind of, you know, get guys, you know, to come in, and they'd sort of say, oh, you know, you can pay something for this, but then if you want to go in the back room, you know, they think they were going to get sex, you know, and of course they didn't. They just got a second woman who was nude that they could, you know, talk to. And so the types of entertainment changed, the type of drugs that were around changed, and things got darker. You know, you could compare it to the beginning of the topless scene, where there was a lot of innocence and optimism and idealism. And then it started to, you know, gradually turn the corner. It's almost like I always kind of compare it to, you know, there was Woodstock and then there was Altamont. And that range and that arc is what happened on Broadway. And it happened really in a lot of cities, that same kind of arc between the mid 60s and the mid 80s.
Hmm. One more question. Well, if we have time too, but we'll start with this one. So I understand you both have been to the Condor for filming of this documentary. Just tell us how it compares to its former grandeur in the heyday of the 60s.
Well, you know, in the, I mean, grandeur is kind of a good word because it was, you know, when Carol started dancing topless, that was a very happening scene. And, you know, everybody went to Broadway for nightclub entertainment. You know, and then as I just, you know, explained, things over the course of, you know, 20 years turned much darker. The Condor is definitely still going today. It's, you know, what you would call a strip club. And it's, you know, the clientele is very different. It's just a whole different world. And unfortunately, a lot of Broadway is the clubs are vacant. You know, there's only a few that are still going. So it's a pretty different world. There is no more grandeur.
I would like to add that at the Condor, I was really happy to see there is a lot of diversity in terms of the body types and the women, where, you know, in the heyday, that was not something that could, like, Black women and women of color were, you know, discriminated against and weren't really invited into that. Whereas today, a plus side is that everyone can dance there.
I think that's something that you brought out in the film as well. It was discussed about the lack of diversity at the time. But it's nice to hear that things have changed, at least over the course of those years. Very quickly, in maybe 60 seconds, can you tell me the story of Barbie the Stripper?
Oh, well, when we first we went to the Condor one time because one of our expert PhD experts in the movie was writing a book, and it's called Tits Up, Sarah Thornton, and she really wanted to go to the Condor, but she didn't want to go alone. So Marlo and I went with her, and you know, when you see Sarah Thornton and Marlo and myself walk into the Condor, it's a little bit of an unusual audience for that club, and so immediately, Barbie, who was a dancer at the club, came up and sat down next to us, and she's like, you know, wearing hardly anything, because she knew that we were on a project of some sort, so it was kind of an interesting scenario. And then Sarah ended up interviewing her for her own book, and so that's the Barbie story.
Okay. Yeah, and I believe the conversation was actually quite intellectual. Barbie is a very intelligent person, and the contrast of the setting and the conversation was fascinating.
Wow. Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we're going to have tonight. But before we leave, if our listeners would like to see Carol Doda topless at the Condor, where should they go?
Well, the film has been released for several weeks, but it is still playing at the Vogue in San Francisco and at the Smith Rafael Film Center in San Rafael. And then it is going to come out. It's going to be released on VOD on May 17th, and you can pre-order it through Apple.
Okay. Marlo, Jonathan, thank you so much for being on the show tonight.
Thank you
so much for having us.
Coming up after the break, we'll be talking with Melicio Estrella, artistic director of the vertical dance company Bendaloop. We'll hear about their upcoming performance this Friday on the side of a building at Sonoma State. And we will be right back.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. We'll talk about something that affects every single person in prison: involuntary servitude.
people want to work. Human beings want to work. People in here want to work. They just don't want to be exploited.
It's a new episode of Uncuffed. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Malacio Estrella, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So you are the artistic director of Bandaloop, a vertical dance company. Let's just start there. What exactly is a vertical dance company?
Yeah, well, we dance vertically. And what that means is in 1991, our company was founded by a woman named Amelia Rudolph, who was a dancer growing up and started climbing in the late 80s and early 90s. Hmm. And right about that time, in the early 90s, 1991, she realized that her dancing could happen on the wall and that the climbing could be a dance. So this inquiry of what happens when you mix dancing and climbing is something that we're still very much asking every wow. building, every cliff we go to. So we use rock climbing technology
okay.
to make vertical surfaces our dance floor.
Is it harder to dance on the side of a building or the side of a cliff than on stage? I mean, it must be. For someone like me who gets vertigo, it would be impossible. But that sounds like it would be challenging.
There are things that are more difficult about it. But I think whether you're dancing on the ground or dancing in the air, there are challenges, but also possibilities that are okay. offered. Physically, our dancers are incredibly strong in their core. And they're mm-hmm. also very adaptive. Like we're bringing the same show to three different sites in these 3 weeks or wow. the same dance material. And each site demands that we pretty drastically change the choreography to adapt to the building.
Okay. Is our choreography completely different every time based on what your surface is? A building versus Yosemite versus in the Himalayas?
Yeah, we've danced in mountains all over the world, in the Himalayas, right. in the Dolomites of Italy. Of course, here in the Sierra, our beautiful home mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And the choreography does change with each show that we do. Thematically, we're working with themes of water, of memory right now. The dancers themselves are the choreographers. We all choreograph together. We all create it together. I act as the artistic director, sort of the master editor to, mm-hmm. and also the first audience member. So I sit out and I relate with the work as it's happening, as it's being created from the outside. The dancers create it from the inside. And that's how our process goes.
I would imagine there's a large amount of trust that would need to be involved with this.
Absolutely. We learn a lot about trust, about how trust is built over time, mm-hmm. about how to quickly be able to trust a building, how to trust your rope, but especially how to trust each other because we're on edges, literal edges and emotional edges with this work. So developing trust and also repairing trust is something that we work with almost every day.
Got it. Let's talk about the mechanics of this. You're pushing yourself out away from the wall and you're doing choreography in the middle of the air. I guess the question is, how challenging is this?
Yeah, well, as much as it is a creative and a dreamlike atmosphere, it's very logistic in terms of how our anchors are built
mm-hmm.
and the riggers that we work with. They're like scientists and they're also like educators. So our culture of safety is really about educating anyone that gets close to a rope or gets on a rope about what the safety system is. And when we know that intellectually, it helps us release more into the dancing. So the beginning of the technical really is our rigging and a technical staff that can assess the safety of the situation and then educate everyone involved about how to go about it in the safest possible way.
Okay.
There's this really fun thing that we deal with called loft, which is when the dancer's rope length gets longer, the jumps get slower and more floaty. So if we have a short rope length of 16 feet,
mm-hmm.
short rope length of 16 feet, the dancer will go a very fast jump, almost like a regular jump on the ground. But then if we go down to 160 feet of rope length above the dancer, a dancer can float for 10 seconds. It really is like a dream.
Well, I was wondering how that works. Mm-hmm. The people who are involved with the ropes and the harness and the safety aspect, are they dancers as well? Or is it a separate team of safety experts who are involved with this company.
We call them our riggers, our rigging team. Okay. And they come from professional backgrounds in mountaineering, in industrial rigging, in theatrical rigging. So it's all kind of a mix, but they're rope craft experts. Okay. And the riggers that work with Vanloop have a real appreciation, a real mind for art making. And that what we're doing here is very creative as much as it is technical.
I mean, the visuals you all come up with are extraordinary. I can't wait to, at some point, be able to see it live. The members of your company, so they're dancers with a rock climbing background. How do you find dancers who can do this? I guess is a better question.
Yeah. When the company started, it was like equal amount rock climbers working with professional dancers. And now we hire dancers first, and then we can teach them to climb. Climbing is so popular now that there's a lot of dancers who love to climb already. Okay. And there's a few dancers in our company who are very committed to the art of climbing and go out to the mountains and go to the climbing gym. But it's much easier to teach a dancer to climb than it is to teach a climber to dance.
I bet that's true. Do people have a fear of heights? I would imagine not, but I'm assuming.
Absolutely. I mean, our fear informs our safety. When it comes to fear, we are human and we are vulnerable. And what the fear does is it points us towards safety. And it really helps us appreciate our lives.
Okay. I've seen a couple of the videos where you're dancing on, you know, sides of mountains, and I think one was in Yosemite. How do you arrange that? Does the Park Service have to sign off on it? I mean, is it tough to get permission to do that?
Yeah, it is tough to get permission. And our executive producer is one of the most experienced people in creating large-scale, high-exposure public artworks that work at verticality. We have a history of collaborating with the National Park Service, collaborating with municipalities. Last year, we were with the City of London at St. Paul's Cathedral. We worked in Munich on the BMW headquarters, those towers. It's really about building relationships, educating people on the safety and why this sort of awe-inspiring public art is valuable for our public spaces to bring people together and to experience something together outside.
Can you tell me about Vanloop Studios?
Yeah, absolutely. It's what a blessing to be able to open two large dance studios in West Oakland when there's such a need for dance space in Oakland for artists to work. We have gorgeous studios, well lit, and we do teach almost all ages. Right now we start at age 9, but we're working on those younger classes. But age 9 and up, vertical dance classes, people can come and try it and come develop their skills anywhere from recreational to pre-professional to professional level classes we offer there. But what the space also does is it gives us a space to incubate our work and also to provide residencies for other artists in the Bay Area who are making their own work, both aerial and not aerial.
Tell us about your performance upcoming at Sonoma State this Friday.
Yeah, so the Green Music Center at Sonoma State University is an amazing gem of a concert hall just 45 miles north of the Golden Gate, is actually the town I grew up in.
Oh, wow. So
I grew up in Rohnert Park, and there's a creek that connects my neighborhood to the Green Music Center. It actually flows down from Sonoma Mountain. It's called Copeland Creek. And so the performance that we're making is inspired by that creek. It's called Downstream. And so the performance is inspired by water and inspired by our memories of being children and what water has given us and how waterways connect us both ecologically and emotionally to our backgrounds.
Wow. Yeah. And if people want information about how to watch this performance, where can they go?
Yeah, you can just search Green Music Center Vanloop and it'll come right up.
That sounds great. Sadly, we are out of time. So Alessio Estrella, Artistic Director of Vertical Dance Company Vanloop, thank you so much for being a guest today on the State of the Bay. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that's the State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us in 2 weeks from now at 6 p.m. when we'll talk about Griffin Dick's new book, Who Killed Kenzo? The Loss of a Son and the Ongoing Battle for Gun Safety. For more information on this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on kalw.org. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen and never miss an episode. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. Email us anytime at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Jillian Emblad and Ann Harper. It was engineered by David Kwan, and Damian Miner was our board operator. I'm Fred Pitts. Good night, and thanks for listening.